Why?
Well, my son, the son, was born, you know, 1st of November, with the great sinking of one of our great battleships in the south. And so my recollections of the First World War are, you see, coloured by the fact that I was home-tied.
I understand.
And I could only do jobs in connection with war work, which I could do as mother of a baby, but with help, and follow my husband round as long as he was in the country, and went home to my own people in Sussex when he went to France.
I understand, yeah.
And therefore, so it was my first experience. He was stationed for the longest time. We were stationed on the East Coast at Lowestoft. And it was my first experience of a small town. I'd lived in pure country and I'd lived in London. And I found it extremely interesting because though one hadn't the impact, the close impact on people you were living with that you had in a country village, you had an immediate and direct effect much more quickly than you could have in London.
Yes, yes, of course.
One was immediately pulled in to Red Cross activities, for instance. And I remember we had a lot of wounded soldiers in the local hospital, and I remember a friend of mine had said what a tremendous help it had been to tuberculosis patients to have needlework. And I suggested to Matron that I should give classes to any man who wanted it, and was immediately swamped with most appalling demands, because of course it was all the regimental symbols that they wanted to put onto cushion covers for their mothers and best girls. And I, who can't draw for toffee, having exhausted the printed ones, had to draw elephants and extraordinary designs. But it was a really it was an enormous success, ending in an exhibition chaired by the mayor with two regimental bands. And to give it a little more body, I got the loan of a very good private exhibition of Eastern embroidery. And I think the most dramatic moment, I went in 3 days before the exhibition to be greeted with intense gloom. A one-handed man had done a most beautiful piece of embroidery on a frame, and by accident ink had been spilt by a fellow. I said, now don't despair, I'll do the best. I may be able to get it right. I posted it to the big cleaners, up in Scotland, explaining what it was.
Yes.
I got it back by return of post. They must have put somebody down to do it. It arrived back in time and won the first prize.
Absolutely marvellous.
I wrote and told, oh dear, they were very, very famous.
Doesn't matter the name, the event is fascinating.
But that was it. And then we were on the front, my husband and I, admiring some warships on the horizon until they started shelling us. When I rushed back to baby and nurse, and my husband dashed to get his men under shelter. And I think it spoke very well for my nerve and Nanny's, that every time a shell burst near us, the two-year-old said a bumpity-bump, bumpity-bump, with totally extreme appreciation. I went on with the Red Cross work, but also ran a canteen for the village children, because it hit the country very badly, the rationing in bread. You see, the women didn't know how to send their men out with a midday meal. And so I got permission to run a canteen for the school children, which was only, were just at the bottom of a small wood between us and the school. But what I think showed how difficult rationing can be, I used to go down to the butcher's in the middle of the week to buy the meat, which the people to whom it was intended couldn't possibly afford to buy. See, the labourer was being offered meat at a price he couldn't afford, when his diet consisted of some form of pork, probably once a week.
Yes.
And, it also shows how extraordinarily conservative people are in their diets, I think. I had to threaten to, if the children wouldn't eat what I could give them, I threatened to say that they were not to come again.
You didn't have, all this was possible for you, I suppose, partly because you had a servant, did you?
Yes. You see, while I was with my husband, we had, of course, we were allocated a soldier servant who were delighted to get away from drill into the more varied pursuits really attached to our household. And when I got to my mother's, we had a large staff in Sussex. That was taken for granted.
Yes, but I really wonder, you see, in the First World War, you get the first big move out of domestic service, really, yes. Don't you? And I wondered whether you personally were in any way affected by that, whether you found it difficult to get servants, or whether they all went off into munitions factories or anything like that.
No, it really, I think, hardly touched either Lowestoft or the country. It was the only form of work that was traditional for the girls.
Yes.
And there's no training.
Yes.
The only way you could get on was starting in a big household, which could give you promotion or train you. If they couldn't employ you at the next step, they trained you up to the next step.
Particularly if you were a country girl, of course.
If you were a country girl, yes.
Yes.
Changed in two directions. Women above a certain income level always had domestic help, and therefore it was incumbent on them, really, to do something in their leisure time, especially in women. And of course, secondly, of course, the church has taken over all that has had to surrender to social service, all the tasks it used to do through voluntary labour.
Yes, yes.
The social and relief work, charity work. I mean, the Lady Bountiful is made fun of, but she was the only help that was available.
Oh yes, yes, I'm sure that's true. So anyway, you were in Lowestoft or in Sussex for the whole of the war,
for
really?
The whole of the war, yes.
And then, what about 1918, Dame Marjorie? I mean, did you actually stand as a candidate in 1918? I can't remember.
Yes. Yes. I got an invitation from the editor of the Liberal paper in Birmingham to stand as Liberal candidate against Austen Chamberlain, which was greeted with hoots of laughter by my family, to be asked to fight a Chamberlain in Birmingham. Was a bit thick, and I went up waving this paper to the executive committee of the National Union of Suffrage Societies, and was horrified when they all said, well, of course you must take it. And so I did, but with, of course, not the faintest idea of getting in, which would have been very inconvenient, but to get people used to the idea of a woman standing for
of course,
them.
Yes.
And it was a very interesting experience. I mean, in a way, I was an experienced campaigner because I'd helped my father in his various campaigns. So, I mean, I knew all the technique about it. But there was one very interesting point. I found the women very sympathetic, but saying, sorry we can't vote for you. It wouldn't be fair. And I said, what do you mean it wouldn't be fair? Well, we oughtn't to have the vote, and our men out there done all the fighting and won the war, and they not have it. And I thought it was rather a touching loyalty.
Did you stand as a coalition Liberal candidate?
No.
As an Asquithian Liberal?
I stood there.
Did
as
you?
A Liberal.
Yes, yes.
And I must say, rather to my surprise, I did as well as the other Liberal candidates, the men around me, you see.
Right.
It was a disastrous election.
Yes, well, did people say, how odd, there's a woman on the platform? And did they actually laugh at you for standing, so to speak? Do you remember ridicule or anything like that?
I don't know. There was a great deal of surprise, but I don't think that there was truly ridicule.
Mm.
Or I may not have taken any notice of it. I mean, one had had so much of it, of being ridiculed for being a suffragist.
Of course, you just didn't notice it.
That they laughed at for being a Liberal or a woman candidate. It probably went off my back.
Yes. You don't remember it being feeling odd being a woman candidate? I mean, you don't remember any sort of...
No, I'm sure I didn't, because, you see, I'd been up to my neck in it in my father's campaigns. Mm. And I was so used to talking politics from a platform.
So really you're on a...
And I think if a person doesn't show any signs of feeling odd, it's perhaps a protection against other people.
I'm sure that's true, yes. Did you get any help from the NUWSS, actually?
From
the NUWSS during the campaign?
Our policy then was to send any help, canvassing and that. As a Liberal candidate, they would send any Liberal volunteer to help me, just as they would have sent a Conservative to help a Conservative woman. But there were very few women candidates, of course. But we continued to work most amicably together, because we were both on the executive of the League of Nations Union, where he was, of course, very advanced and very, very good.
So did you, I mean, after that election, you did quite respectably, did you stay as candidate, Liberal candidate there, or did you give up the idea?
No, I gave up the idea. It was too awkward being so. You see, when my husband got home, it would have been expensive and difficult to fight a campaign away from home.
Even with the servants?
Yes.
Yes.
Money.
Yes.
What you were going to do with Europe.
And the Kaiser.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, there is this sort of distraction in a way from the women's movement. Which,
and then, of course, you see, the moment women had the vote, they broke up into as many different opinions as men. Men had been obsessed with the idea that there would be immediately a woman's party anti-man, not realizing that what we were asking for the vote because we wanted to be treated as individuals with individual opinions, and therefore, you see, we were bound to fragment. The only thing we could hope for was a certain solidarity on social legislation. And that, in a sense, we did get, because as the number of women MPs increased in the House, they would work together on raise the age of marriage or raise the age of consent or... domestic things.
Family questions.
There would be a great deal more cooperation and some rebellion, I mean, against their own party.
Mm. Yes, of course, another thing is that a lot of women, in fact, go into international work, don't they?
Yes. I mean, actually, foreign policy is one of the things which I think, which they call peace, but which... really is foreign policy, attracts an enormous number of women. And one of the reasons, I think, which weakened the Liberal Party after the war was that in the overwhelming majority of cases, the League of Nations Society had Liberal women as secretary or president.
Or
Liberal men,
yes.
But it was the Liberals who supplied up and down the country the administrative know-how which the League of Nations societies needed.
Very interesting, yes. I mean, so that in a way women are drained off politically from their main preoccupation by concern with foreign policy and things like
yes.
that. Yes. And also by concern with class questions like labour or socialism or whatever.
Yes.
Trade union things.
Yes.
So...
I had to devote a good deal of our energy in the two other things which interested us, our party and, but above all, I think, the League of Nations Union. Which we felt was the great hope for the stable peace.
What actually happened then after the 1918 campaign? You went back to looking after your son and your husband.
Yes.
What you remained on the committee, did you, of the NUWSS
yes.
the way through? Did you?
All the way through, I think. Mm. I mean, I think I was always re-elected.
And you, yes, because Eleanor Rathbone took over in 1918, didn't she, I think?
Oh, yeah, she succeeded the Mason Fawcett, who felt she was getting, felt that under the new conditions, a younger woman would be a better leader. She was a very, Mason Fawcett was a very generous woman. She didn't seem to care a pin if she got the credit or if she did it. She would try and get the best person. I remember her writing to me saying she'd been invited to address one of the Oxford colleges and she thought I was a much better age to go and talk to the admin. So up I went.
She stood down, really, in favour of Eleanor Rathbone just because she thought there should be a younger person.
Oh, no,
person.
I didn't know that. I don't think I were about I don't think... she'd done such tremendous work up in Liverpool. She deserved it. I mean, her achievements were very much greater than mine.
Oh yes, I wasn't thinking that she was competing with you. I was really thinking about between her and Mrs. Fawcett.
Mrs. Fawcett resigned.
Yes, I mean...
And we had to find a new...
She resigned because she was too old, really, didn't
yes,
she?
Or, yes, she yes. felt that yes. somebody more in touch with the young ought to...
Because Eleanor Rathbone was a great success, really, wasn't she?
Tremendous.
Did you feel that at the time?
Yes. We all had the greatest admiration and affection for her. She was passionately interested in anything she took up and would flush up like a, we used to say, like a turkey cock in defence of her ideas. Oh yes, she was the most stimulating person to work with.
Very intelligent too, wasn't she? I mean, a sharp-minded woman.
Yes. And of course, and very, a great political flair. She got the children's allowances paid to the mother against the whole legal profession.
I mean, she terrified the civil servants, didn't she? I think terrified the politicians. Is that not so? I mean, she just was rather impressive.
Oh, she was a terrific person, yes. Rather.
But there's another example of a woman, in a sense, distracted by foreign policy because she goes off, she gets involved in India, doesn't she?
Very much, yes.
And refugees and things like that, and Israel later.
Oh, she was a very big-hearted woman.
Yes.
And India, she did a great deal for the Indian community.
Supported Eleanor Rathbone on the family allowance question, didn't you? I mean, there was a disagreement, wasn't there, around about 1927 or so, about whether family allowances should become NUWSS policy.
Yes.
And there was a split about it, wasn't there? Or at least there were quite a lot of disagreements.
Yeah, there was a disagreement as to whether it was wise for us as a woman's...
And as far as I remember, but you must correct me if I'm wrong, you were on her side, weren't
you?
Yes. Yes. Well, can you generalise about what was going on then? Because it's very difficult to, I mean, one can't really understand the alignments from looking at the written reports. I mean, very often the real story is rather different from what's published. I don't know whether that is so in that case. I mean, very often disagreements about policy reflect personal antagonisms or antagonisms about the overall direction the movement should take, which, you know.
I think we were really extremely lucky in avoiding personal antagonisms. I can't really we got impatient with a colleague, but I can't remember any. There was never a real feud that I can remember.
No, it really was the issue that was important.
Yes, it was the issue that we argued about.
It wasn't a disagreement about the way in which the National Union should be led at all, you think?
No, we would have to discuss on the executive, you see, how much support and where we were going to give it, whether we should add children's allowances to the... it's difficult now thinking back to know which arguments were the most important. But I think a lot of people who would have been rather hesitant about adopting it, if it had been merely the welfare of the children, felt it would be the one reform which would give the mother a status in the family. And I think we, the NUWSNS, really backed it, because we felt it was such enormous importance. For the first time, if it was paid to the mother, she would have a status inside the family and wouldn't be purely a dependent.
Do you remember what Eleanor Rathbone was like in the chair?
Yes. She was a fine, big woman, handsome, very handsome. I'm wondering, yes, there are very few photographs of her, I think.
Yes, I haven't got a picture of her in my mind.
I wonder if she's in the National Gallery.
She probably is, actually.
She probably is.
But I was wondering, you know, did she dominate executive committee meetings, do you remember? I mean, and if so, how?
Oh.
That's rather a difficult question, isn't it?
Yes, well, you see, we had a lot of very individual and forceful people on the executive. I would say that though her presence and her forcible way of putting her case would all have an effect, she was talking to people who were her equal in, yes.
Like Mary Stocks, for
instance. Mary Stocks, you can't imagine just being like a turkey cock would impress Mary Stocks.
No, I take your point.
And I was thinking some of the, some of the other people. Not in the line, she wasn't in the line. She was a very good, clear-headed administrator, but she couldn't have led in the way that Eleanor.
No, she was a behind-the-scenes person.
Invaluable behind the scenes.
Yes. Why create the six-point group?
There are always people who are purists. And the six-point group would, on the whole, I think, be against our taking up children's allowances, because they couldn't see the second-hand implications of equality. And they wanted it to be a very narrow and strictly equality program. I thought they were extremely difficult to work with. I would have said rather narrow-minded enthusiasts.
What sort of relationship did they have to the WSPU? The WSPU, of course, had been disbanded, hadn't it? But
yes. Well, they were, I think you'll find, I would have, I wouldn't say it, but I should have thought they were all members of the WSPU,
so
who came together in a new effort, you see.
I understand, yes. Of course, Dorothy Evans is one who was an old suffragette.
Yes.
There are others, I agree.
I think, yes. You see, the, I don't know if you've seen the cover of one of the magazines, which brought together the surviving leaders of all three suffrage societies. But it was very interesting that the people who survived from the NUWS, like Mary Stocks and Kathleen Courtney and me, and I, all went on and did things afterwards. And if you look at the people who were alive from the days of the WSPU and the Women's Freedom League, you'll only find one or two who went on to do constructive work with the vote behind them. The others, having won the fight, seemed to fall out of constructive work.
Of course, that happened.
If you're, you may be good at fighting, but not in administering or formulating constructive policy.
Or getting on with politicians.
Or getting on with
like
politicians.
Eva Hubbard.
Yes.
I mean, she, I believe, could get on very well with politicians.
Oh, she was very good, yes.
Mm.
And of course, she went on to run that college. Morley College, which brought in touch with all sorts of people.
Mm.
And it was she who really had the idea of what became the Towns Women's Guild.
Yes.
She wrote to me and said, it seems such a pity now we've got the vote to lose all this expertise, and our committees have all held together during the war. Surely we can use them to get what we want with the vote. And we elaborate.
See, so the Towns Women's Guild really grows out of that.
And it's great, yes. She and I, well, I think she had the idea that we ought keep our groups of expert women in existence and turn them on to getting equality. And I had been an original member of one of the first women's institutes and suggested that we form a society with a program on the lines of the triple program of the Women's Institute, but change the program to fit urban women instead of rural women. And so the 3-point program of WI was agriculture and education and recreation, I think. You'd have to check up to get quite accurate.
Yeah.
And I suggested that we should put in citizenship instead of agriculture, and then have the triple, which would cater for women's crafts and social work. And it we tried it out in a small country town, a new settlement. But you know, when people are moved into a new area and have no links and are terribly lonely.
Yes.
And we found the Towns Women's Guild was an enormous help.
Do you remember which town it was that where you tried it out first? Then you tried it out in one place, did you?
We've tried it out, I think, in 3 or 4 rather different. I know one was a cathedral town, and one or two were newly developed parts of London.
Mm.
And
so you chose different types of town.
We tried it out in different types.
Good idea,
different types of town. And my dear, I don't know how much of the early work the Towns Women's Guild have, but I'm sure they'd let you.
What was the relationship between the women's institutes and the women's movement?
We worked out perfectly an agreed division of territory.
I see.
The women's institutes, except in the few instances in which they got a federated centre in a town, were to be restricted to places under such a level of population. And the Towns Women's Guild were to take over in the rest of the country, so to speak. But both sides feeling it quite urgent to keep the separate characteristics, you see, that the Women's Institute should continue to be a rural activity.
With emphasis on sort of jam making.
With the emphasis on agriculture, jam making, poultry rearing, all the basket weaving, I mean, all the all the traditional country crafts in a modern form would be really the main, the increase of food, for instance. The WIs did a tremendous work in the war years increasing the...
Did the WIs actually originate in the women's movement or not?
No. They were started by a pioneer from Canada, where the Women's Institute had grown up, I think really to formalize the way in which, in a very scattered community, if one farm would call in all the others round it, 20 mile radius or whatever, 30 mile radius, as a group to do it, and then you see, then you can move to the next group. But it was, it grew out of the necessary cooperation in scattered rural communities. And it did so well in developing women's crafts that, I can't remember the name of the woman, brought it over. Mm. And my institute, Dame Hill, was one, I think, of the first five in England.
You immediately supported it, did you?
Yes, I was very young to take a leading part, but my mother became president of the local. Well, she refused to take it on, and we got a very able woman from the village who unfortunately died quite suddenly, and my mother took it over.
And then she ran it for a
time and ran it.
Mm. And obviously, in a way, one should look at the history of women after 1918, outside the women's movement rather more, because there are lots of sort of ancillary movements that become important, aren't they?
Yes, because of course all along we'd only thought of the vote as a tool. And therefore what we were preoccupied with when we got the tool was to use it. Well then of course the moment you talk of using a tool, give any tool to any person and they'll use it differently.
Or
for a different object, won't they?
But getting back to the earlier thing we were talking about, would you accept this or not? Is this really putting it too far? That the antagonism, or the dispute anyway, or the divergence between the WSPU and the NUWSS continues after 1918 in the form of friction, divergence, however you like to put it, between the six-point group and the National Union of Societies for Equal Citizenship?
Yes. The friction continued, but I don't know how they would look at it. But of course, we looked at it as really irrelevant. We were getting a stronger and stronger body when we created the Towns Women's Guild. We were getting new recruits to our side, and they were remaining a small, shall we say, specialized body. So I don't think there was really much, I don't think there was antagonism, because...
You just specialized in different areas.
We just specialized in different areas.
Interesting, yes.
Asking about women for Westminster. I think a good many feminists were disappointed that more women didn't go in to politics for Parliament and didn't realize the strength, the dead weight that there would be against women, and thought that it would be a good plan to have a body that would specialize on trying to find women candidates and trying to get them fitted in and accepted as candidates. Mm. But that again was a very small movement in numbers.
Yes, it was. Yes.
Really got to. And you switch it on. It was enormously generous to the women's movement during the war. She kept our international paper going. And she also put women for Westminster on their feet, and they treated her extremely badly.
Did they?
Never gave her any credit or any thanks. They made me furious. I remember a meeting. At which they completely ignored her. She came into the room and they didn't invite her onto the platform or anything.
Why do you think that was, actually? I mean, because she was a Jewess or what?
I'm afraid the people in the Six Point group rather despised everybody who didn't adopt their particular point of view. And I suppose Mrs. Seep wasn't sufficiently single-minded on a very narrow platform.
I see, she provided the money, did she? But
yes, they took the money, but gave no thanks. Oh yes,
rather
they took the money.
Extraordinary.
I must say I resented it very much.
Yes. She eventually became very interested, didn't she, in Zionism.
Really. Oh yes, she went over completely and ended her days in Israel. Did an enormous amount for the women there.
Why did she actually connect herself at all with the Six Point Group?
Well, I think she was a real feminist, and there was an organization which she was in full sympathy, badly in need of funds, and just as she'd helped the International Women's News, it was a poor dedication to, she could expect nothing out of it. Only, I mean, you do expect the beginnings of courtesy.
Yes, it's interesting, I hadn't realised that. There is, you see...
Yes, I think you'll see that what you might call the constitutional side of the movement, not the militant, the constitutional side was, if you like, obsessed by the idea we'd got the tool, how are we going to use it? And then everybody, you see, some people thought, oh, back the League of Nations, and that took off a lot of people. Other people wanted social legislation. The Labour people were busy, you see, with their particular programme. And I think it was the fact that women, the leaders of the women, of the women's movement, were taking their new responsibilities so seriously that really caused the fragmentation. They weren't sitting down to some theoretic aim. They were working at specific practical projects.
And that inevitably,
there was a very strong local government society. If you come across that, I think she left in the same way as
Teresa Billington.
The other Hoover, the man, and
Pedrick Lawrence, as you mean.
The Hoover, who broke away.
The Pedrick Lawrence.
The Pedrick Lawrence. Yes. You see, they really could not stand the autocratic. You see, all the thousands of pounds they raised, they never accounted for a penny. And I think they used the money for the purpose for which it was given. But you see, you can't, you either admit that that kind of autocracy is the right way to do things, or you really must rebel. And I think Lawton and the Pedrick Lawrences and a lot of other people
wouldn't stick it.
You see, couldn't accept that way of.
But the interesting thing is that when Christabel's in difficulties, they'll still help her out, even though they've left.
Yes, I think there was an underlying loyalty, but solidarity, I won't say loyalty, but there was an underlying solidarity. And of course that, looking back, is what I think really gave such a tremendous thrill to young people coming in, that, you see, brought up in an age when women were really brought up on don't and can't, either you can't or you don't, to discover that we were immensely loyal to other women instead of being proverbially catty, that we could organise, we could raise money, we could do all the things that we now dare we could do. And you know, the exhilaration was terrific. This new loyalty, this new opening up of tremendous possibilities made it a most exciting time.
And that loyalty and excitement didn't carry on after 1918, you'd say? Or?
Oh yes, it's existed to this day, I think. I think women are very, on the whole, quite as loyal in the same way as men are loyal to each other. You find people with whom you agree and you back them up and that. I used experts. Really, there wasn't a trick of parliamentary procedure that hadn't been taught us the hard way.
Whereas, in a way, the WSPU would never try.
Never tried to work, you see. No, I think that's why when we got the vote, the people in the constitutional side fitted at once into the pattern. Whereas, you see, it was quite, it would be an entirely new line for the WSP.
Did you stand again after 1918?
Yes, I think I've stood five times.
Have you really? I really ought to stand that.
Yes, now.
All through the
20s,
was it?
Yes, I stood the first time in Birmingham. And you know, I can't remember what. I'd stood twice, I think, for Richmond, which was, you see, within.
Richmond and Middlesex.
Our house. And once in Hempstead. And then once, which. Blotted my copybook very badly. Once during the war, when there was supposed to be a political truce, and I was asked if I would stand as a Liberal for Bury St Edmunds.
At a by-election.
And I said, yes, I went up, and I was told the Labour people would not run a candidate if I satisfied them that I would be a good fighter against the sitting Conservative member. And of course the party disowned me and was very angry with me. But I fought it on Beveridge's social policy. And he said that it was that by-election that got his plan accepted.
Did he tell you that it was worth it? Yes.
But it was an astounding election. Bury St Edmunds is supposed to be the place of Dickens' famous election. And you know, conditions had hardly changed at all. There was exactly the same corruption.
Violence and drink.
And drink.
Wasn't any.
And really terrible conditions.
Was that the last election you contested then, that one? Or did you stand in 1945?
So. No, I don't think so. I was feeling very strongly about Beveridge, which was being pushed into the corner at a time when it really was desperately needed. And I explained that I would like to stand on that, what I thought was really a non-party. It was a non-party issue, really, or should have been.
Did Beveridge actually encourage you to stand? I mean, did you correspond with him?
I don't think I'd better say that. I'm not quite sure.
Yes,
fair enough. He certainly thanked me afterwards.
Did he? Yes,
because I don't know whether he would like to implicate himself in the
fight. No, fair enough. But he did, of course, stand in 1945, didn't
yes.
he? And was very prominent in the 1945
yes.
general election campaign.
Yes. You see, that was one thing that I think there are two things that have told against women. First of all, I think they haven't realized that you've got to go in on the ground floor and work your way up. And secondly, I think, you know, that women have been so conditioned to see something practical come out of their work, that whereas local government attracts them very much, because there, if you're a councillor, you really do see, you do get the children's home built, you do get the flats for old people, you see what you may have to work for years on it, but at last you see a result. And you see, if you go into Parliament, very, very seldom see any direct result. Eleanor Rathbone was wonderfully fortunate in really seeing a great achievement with her bill. And now who else? Mary MacArthur, I think, who got the charter for shop girls through, I think. You see, you can pin on to a few women some definite result, but otherwise, you see, you may sit for years, and though you've been beavering along in committees and that, you can't say to yourself, well, I got that through.
It's not satisfying.
And then, of course, the hours make it almost impossible for a married woman. Well, see, this is pretty difficult for a married man. The wives are now protesting that it breaks up family life. And of course that, in the case of a woman, is by convention has more effect on her than on the husband. Husbands have been used to going off regardless of the effect on the home.
So really, for the vote to be really effective in giving equality politically to women, you've got to educate men about their function in the family.
Well, their function in the family.
Which is a very
yes.
big job. Yes.
Yes. Though yes. I am very surprised at the way in which my grandson's friends come down in the country and get up without a word and help clear them. Into the kitchen and...
Yeah. I think things have changed.
Well, so the things have changed. Mm. They were starting to change. And 1914 started a certain amount of movement.
And that's really quite separate from politics. I mean, politics
quite,
hasn't
quite,
affected that at
quite
all.
Quite different. Quite yeah. separate from politics, yes.
Would you say, I mean, presumably you did have political ambitions in a way. I mean, if you stood for Parliament quite often like this, I mean, you would have liked a political career, perhaps, would you?
Do you know, I really, looking back, I never expected to get in. I took on a seat because I was fighting for things I believed in, but I never thought there was a chance of actually getting into Parliament.
Because you were a Liberal, really?
Yes, I struck the bad patch in.
Yes, I mean, in a way, if you joined the Labour Party
or the Conservative Party,
you would have been all right, wouldn't you?
I could have been given a safe seat, I think,
you might have had a better chance,
seat.
Anyway. Yes.
But it was, I struck it.
No.
To succeed.
No.
I was up against too great a handicap, I knew, in that particular, whichever constituency I took on. I knew I was doing an almost hopeless,
as a liberal,
quite hopeless as a liberal, and where I was getting satisfaction was through the International Alliance with my doing international work.
Yes, yes.
That was giving me so much satisfaction and so much work.
So in a way, your politics was only a sideline for a lot of the time.
Really.
Yes, that's also very interesting. But you wouldn't in any way put down the fact that you didn't get into Parliament to the fact that the Liberal Party was run by men. I mean, that's not got anything to do with it.
No,
really.
I think it was the philosophy of the parties and the economic outlook of the parties.
I mean, if you'd... As we say, if you'd been a Conservative or a Labour candidate, you probably would have got somewhere.
Yes.
Yes, yes. I'm sure you're right on that.
I think
I'm sure that's right. But do tell me now, Dame Marjorie, if you feel like carrying on, about your international work. I mean, because we haven't done that at all, really. How did you get involved in that?
My mother was to go as delegate to the International Council of Women in Berlin the year I left Newnham, and she took me and my sister, and it was my first contact with women from other countries, and I was tremendously impressed by the USA delegation of really most remarkable pioneers in the feminist movement. And they'd come over in 1902, to go back really to the beginning, they'd invited over continental feminists to talk to their suffrage society. And they'd been so impressed by the value of this get-together, they came over to Berlin in 1904 to ask the International Council of Women to add suffrage to its program. And when the International Council refused on the ground it would do too much damage to their educational and social work, it was agreed quite amicably to start an international spearhead organization of women who would only ask for suffrage and eligibility. And that was the start of the International Alliance of Women. Well, I joined it in 1904.
Did you
realize
that?
Eventually got on to the executive, and then through an accident, Crystal Macmillan was to have been the secretary and recorder of Congress in Geneva, and her eyes gave her trouble, and I was pushed in as secretary interpreter. And from that became on secretary. You see, I was almost bilingual in French and very fluent in German, which were our three languages. So that was an enormous help.
And you had a lot of political experience as well.
I'd got plenty of political experience behind me. And so I started, and I think I've helped the women's movement in 27 different countries.
So what did you actually do as... you were secretary all through the interwar period, were you?
Then I was still on the executive, but we had an honorary secretary out in Geneva, Mademoiselle Gore, and I was...
You were the main English person, were you?
Yes.
I mean, obviously one could check up the details,
yes.
That was your main feminist organization and activity, was it?
Yes.
At this period?
Yes.
Yeah.
And in, I'm trying to think the date, for about 3 years I was also a poor law guardian, but that was in the very bad period of unemployment, 33.
Mm. But your main emphasis was outside England,
outside
in a way.
England,
and so
yes.
What this organisation, did it have branches then in England?
Yeah, it's got affiliate. Yes, you see the NUWSS was the English affiliate.
I see. So it was really a sort of committee of English women's bodies, was it? All affiliated together, and you represented all of them.
You see, there would be one or two of... I think at that time we had only one affiliate in each country, the leading suffrage society.
I see. So
in each country became affiliate to the International Alliance.
I see, yes.
We had congresses at which we tried to hammer out a universal program that could be interpreted and either expanded or reduced according to the national conditions.
Of course, in a way, this is another thing, I suppose one could say, that what happens after 1918, you've got the vote here, then the campaign takes off, in a sense, doesn't it? And it becomes an international campaign, because you, in alliance with the Americans and some Scandinavian countries, want to spread women's suffrage elsewhere.
Elsewhere, you see. I think we started the alliance with seven countries in 1904, the only two non-Europeans being Australia and USA. And the others were Norway, Sweden, Denmark, France,
Finland?
And Germany.
Oh yes. Because that involved what, a series of... Was it a sort of pressure group on the United, on the League of Nations, really, this? Or was it more?
Well, of course, I went out each year to the Assembly of the League of Nations as spokeswoman for this international alliance. First three official delegates to the League, women official delegates to the League of Nations, were our women.
Were they really?
They were our leading women in the three Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden and Denmark. Mm. They were the first. And then there was, not many women.
Mm.
And then there was the disarmament conference, which was, of course, much later.
But the objectives of the...
International Alliance for Suffrage, for Women's Suffrage. And we've had to change its title when all the countries have given votes to women, so it's now called the International Alliance of Women.
I see. So originally it was really a sort of international pressure group for votes for women,
that was its only object.
Yes. And did it broaden its objects as time went on?
Yes, time went on. As one country after another gave women the vote, we had to divide our programme. The vote where women hadn't got it, but a social programme for reform towards equality for the countries that were already enfranchised.
I understand. So it's steadily growing in its range of interest, really.
And our latest expansion has been into the newly independent African countries, English-speaking or French-speaking, where we run the seminars on teaching women citizenship and social responsibility.
Yes.
Encouraging them, rather. I mean, we have to adapt it.
What happened, how did you maintain contact with the National Union then? I mean, did you, you're on the executive committee, I suppose, and so you knew what they were doing.
Yes, I knew what they were doing, you see.
And they gave you instructions, didn't they?
They would tell me what they wanted put forward as from them. But of course they also sent out their own delegate.
Oh, did they?
Oh yes, they sent out. Our Congress is... of course, lately travel has been so difficult and restricted and expensive, but at one time each country could send 20 delegates, 10 I think it was 10 delegates and 10 alternates, something like that, or 12. And so you got a very good and very well informed forum for discussing what pressure and could be put on separate governments. We were very punctilious. We were never allowed to approach a government without the prior consent of the national. As you see, foreign interference might do more harm than good.
Of course, yes. Yes.
And as you could ask for some things in one country which would be fatal to the movement in another. There was one case when we had the Congress in Paris, where the Senate had already once passed the first stage of a suffrage bill, years and years before it was finally given, and we were warned that sister of the Archbishop of Paris was to be one of the patrons, and therefore would we not introduce women's equality in the church? So, to which of course we agreed the French Suffrage Society was to be our hostess, and a separate delegation from our own affiliate arrived from New York, arrived from the USA, under the charge of a woman very much like Mrs. Pankhurst. And I briefed the heads of delegations. I said, we can talk of everything, but we have undertaken that we will not raise the position of women in the church. There's plenty for us to do apart from that. And that wretched woman sent in a long article to the Paris press asking for women's equality in the church. However, that dished her. I got up and I was absolutely furious. I got up and said, we've had the application from, what they called it now, Second Society in the USA, whose objects seem to be entirely in accord with our constitution, and I think we shouldn't have been, I should have had to recommend their admission. But I said, they've sent a long article to the press before their admission, on which we'd put a complete embargo. And if they're disloyal to us before they joined, I suggest we do not accept them.
And that happened?
That settled it. All or part. So it gave really complete liberty of political, complete political liberty. So